From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Oakland in the Temescal neighborhood.
Jack London Square.
Fruitvale.
Adams Point.
Grand Lake neighborhood.
Maxwell Park.
I'm from Oakland and I live in the Laurel District.
Coming up, a UC Berkeley course teaches one of our reporters how to forgive.
You know what happens? It's an amazing thing. You don't feel this need to complain about your life.
Then we meet the Muslim woman comic who's stirring the pot.
I get fans at like comedy shows saying, oh, you're the good kind of Muslim because you're less Muslim.
And we stumble upon one of the city's best kept secrets, a scenic trail that gets philosophical about the history of Southeast San Francisco.
Being out in a healthy environment is probably going to lead to healthier thoughts, wiser decisions, a better life.
We're getting contemplative today on Cross Currents. What does happiness mean to you?
Farmers markets make me happy.
My grandchildren.
People smiling kind of spontaneously. That makes me happy.
Beautiful woman.
Big hearts make me happy.
Nice music.
Being with good friends.
And a good bourbon.
My cats make me happy.
Those were the voices of Donya Sachs-March, Margie Chassett, and Edward Smith. Clearly, there's no one recipe for finding happiness, but there's a science for it. UC Berkeley is covering the topic in a free online course called The Science of Happiness. The class began in September 2014, and it's been a huge success worldwide. KALW's Liz Mack is one of over 200,000 students who signed up.
UC Berkeley is known for world-class scientists in various disciplines, physics, chemistry, biology. And just a few blocks away from campus, you'll find Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, where they have one scientist who's focusing on a different subject, happiness. Emiliana Simon-Thomas has a PhD in cognition, brain, and behavior. She's also the science director of the Greater Good Science Center. I asked her, how would you define happiness? She says, there's no one definition, but if she had to give one...
Happiness has to do with having an easy time of feeling positive emotions, being quick at recovering from negative emotions, although you do experience them, and having a sense of meaning and purpose that is tied to the collective. I'm contributing in this meaningful way to the people around me.
I'm talking to Simon Thomas at her office in Berkeley. On her desk, she's got a mug where she keeps her pens. It says six habits of happiness worth cultivating. Things like drop grudges, give thanks, practice kindness. It's saying there's a lot of different components to being happy. And that's what her course says, too. The way it works is it's self-paced. For 8 weeks, the center puts a new lesson online every week, each analyzing a specific component of happiness: social connection, compassion, gratitude, cooperation.
The first week is an intro to what is the science of happiness. The second week is about human connection. The third week is about kindness and compassion. The fourth week is about reconciliation.
The course draws from scientific studies, but Simon Thomas says the point of the class isn't just to teach students how these relate theoretically to happiness. It's also to give people tools to live the best lives they can.
To really find their groove.
One of those first lessons is that sometimes finding happiness can be uncomfortable. Take the fourth week of the course. Our assignment is to find someone you think has wronged you and learn to forgive them in just 8 steps. Simon Thomas says there's scientific evidence that forgiveness is an important part of happiness.
There used to be this kind of overarching belief that primates who had conflict would then run away from each other and just stay separate because they would realize, oh, that's a hostile person. I'm not going too close to them again. They don't do that. A lot of the time, they actually come back towards one another and they reconcile.
Simon Thomas says, as humans, we also do this.
I often turn to these primate studies because I feel like we want to just convince people that this isn't stuff we have to learn from our culture, and you know, it's not politeness. It's our biological endowment for cooperation and reconciliation.
And that's how I find myself calling up an ex-boyfriend as part of an exercise for this class.
I'm gonna give a call to Albert.
It's been several weeks since Albert moved to New York and we broke up.
Oh my god, I'm so nervous right now.
During the end of our relationship, Albert's attention was elsewhere, professionally and personally. And for the last part of it, I didn't feel important to him. I really thought I had forgiven him. And yet I still found myself getting mad at him.
Hello?
So I call him up and we chat back and forth for an hour. The whole time, I'm thinking about this one part of the exercise. See if the conversation makes you feel more compassion. Nothing. And then Albert says something.
I think it's been rare that, you know, you've believed that I was trying. Even though I felt like I was trying pretty hard, it would have been nice, you know, to feel like my efforts meant something.
Albert's been good about acknowledging my efforts. Maybe I can put more effort into acknowledging his.
I think what I could give you is, like, I could say thank you. And I think I can tell you when I notice things that you do. And, you know, try to be more open to noticing them in the first place.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I really do.
This marked the first time I really understood where Albert was coming from. That it wasn't about a lack of caring for me. And this exercise helped me to forgive in a way I couldn't before. To find out why forgiveness is so linked to happiness, I turned to Dr. Fred Luskin.
My name is Fred Luskin, and I teach at Stanford the happiness classes.
He's an authority on positive psychology. He says after forgiving someone, things change.
You don't feel this need to complain about your life. So when you have a grudge or you're wounded, this urge to come and tell people and to blame stuff on it and to just feel like life has done you a bad turn, it disappears. And you find that you end up wanting to talk more about what's good.
And the course says that's a big part of happiness, appreciating the good. Luskin says in the past, psychology used to focus on the things that are wrong with people. It's only been relatively recently that psychologists began to research and teach positive traits like hope, compassion, and forgiveness. Luskin says these are things that people used to associate mainly with religion and spirituality. But now we're also studying them as a part of science.
What may have been owned by religious traditions such as forgiveness, being kind, being generous, being grateful, those are also secular qualities. But they were kept away from mainstream science because religion kind of owned them, and now they're being blended.
This is what the Greater Good Science Center is doing with the Science of Happiness course, giving people tools they can use, whether they believe in religion or not. One of my fellow students, Anne Hardy, says one of her tools is a newfound sense of empowerment. She says having a list of steps and assignments makes it easier to make changes in your life.
I mean, you're afraid of something because you don't know exactly how to do it, and having some sort of steps that you follow makes it more automatic. It gives you the courage because you don't think so much about the fear that you may have because, yeah, it's like, okay, so I'll do that and I'll do that and I'll do this and it's gonna work.
In the beginning, I wondered how anyone could teach something like happiness. I think what I found, along with Anne Hardy and other students, was that you teach happiness step by step, one exercise at a time, and then you practice them over and over. For Cross Currents, I'm Liz Mack.
That story originally aired in February 2015 as part of KALW's project, The Spiritual Edge, Stories at the Intersection of Innovation and Belief. To hear more Spiritual Edge pieces, go to kalw.org. And just so you know, the Greater Good Science Center receives funding from the Templeton Foundation. The Spiritual Edge is funded by the Templeton Religion Trust. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. This election season, the happiness of many communities is being challenged. From Donald Trump's attacking of Latinos to Ted Cruz calling for patrolling and securing Muslim neighborhoods, some of the political rhetoric this year can be downright depressing. And for the Muslim community, laughter can be a good antidote. Enter Zahra Norbakhsh.
She's a comedian and hosts the podcast Good Muslim, Bad Muslim with her co-host Tanzila Ahmed. Zahra sat down with me to talk about the podcast and about being Muslim nowadays.
Taz and I started claiming sort of good Muslim, bad Muslim in jest, in hashtags on Twitter, and just talking about how the things that make us good Muslims within the community of Muslims, whatever singular monolithic ogre that is and has become now, are the same things that make us bad Muslims, and vice versa. There's no winning. You can't win.
So, like what?
Well, for instance, I eat pork. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
I drink.
Dun, dun, dun.
Right. And I'm married to an atheist, whitey white, infidel man.
Dun, 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 dun.
Dun, 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 dun. And it's interesting because then when I say that, I get fans at like comedy shows and gigs saying, oh, you're the good kind of Muslim. But the connotation is because you're less Muslim. Which is pretty gross.
Hmm. So pretty you're gross. Safer.
To them, mm-hmm. somehow. Mm-hmm. I'm less threatening because I'm less Muslim. At the same time, all of those things are actually what make me a bad Muslim, technically speaking, because you're not supposed to do those things. And I think it's funny because my husband, for example, he's atheist, but he doesn't eat pork because he's against it for political reasons. And he doesn't drink. He doesn't like to drink. And so is he more Muslim than me? So it's just, it's a fascinating topic. And I also think it's interesting to hear people talk about extremists because it creates a spectrum. All of a sudden, there's a spectrum of very, very Muslim, too Muslim, extremely Muslim, and then less Muslim. So I like to play with that in my comedy. And the way that I play with that and the way that I dialogue with these issues and the way my co-host dialogues about these issues are different. And so they bring, when we come together for this podcast, it sort of brings this great conversation up that nobody else is having in the media that we get to then have and has now become a part of that conversation.
Hmm. Let's listen to this clip from one of your latest episodes.
When somebody first described Santa to me when I was little,
yeah,
they said he's an old man that brings presents to kids. He's this old guy with a long white beard and robes. And I thought that they were talking about Khomeini. I'm actually not joking.
I know you're not joking. I'm laughing. Because that's amazing.
I mean, because I was basically indoctrinated.
Like Khomeini, Santa, side by side.
They look the same. And they said that he had a hat. Khomeini had a hat.
Yeah, this is true.
And I was like, Khomeini brought us better than toys. He brought us revolution. He brought us freedom of religion. I was an impressionable young child.
Yeah, clearly. Clearly. Santa Khomeini has done a number on you.
It worked.
So that's a clip from the podcast Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, hosted by Zahra Noorbakhsh and Tanzila Ahmed. With me is Zahra. You know, you're living at a time where there is a lot of change. There are Islamophobia is on the rise. There's no shortage of material, so to speak. What does that mean for you and a podcast like yours?
Publicity. publicity. Lots of publicity, just topical all the time. So much media love.
Hmm.
What it means is that when we want to, sometimes we want to just talk about Christmas, Muslim Christmas. You know, sometimes we want to just talk about our Valentine's Day hangovers. You know, we want to be able to talk about what our Thanksgiving looks like. And we can't. We have to talk about the San Bernardino shooting. We have to talk about Charlie Hebdo. It makes it so that because the situation right now for a lot of Muslims globally is that when you speak on behalf of all Muslims. When you act on behalf of all Muslims for all Muslims. It makes it so that these questions are coming up and people are looking to us for those answers. And so we have to ask ourselves constantly as artists, as activists, do we address it? What does it mean for us to address it?
So you said something about that, about you're conflicted sometimes about joking about Donald Trump because that's just more publicity and just more media and just more talking about him. Can you talk about that conflict a little bit and talk about him now on the media?
Right, exactly. You know, I just periscoped a segment with him to his Nevada win speech, where he was like, I've got NRA and NRA right here, Nevada, this is America. And I peed my pants in terror. Talk about terrorism. I issued a fatwa on people who see Trump as farce. We'll see how that goes. Mm. Because it's become dangerous. And as a comedian, I know what he's doing. It is getting by and past people's defenses with comedy, with absurdity, but for an insidious cause. I am the antithesis to Trump right now. Feminist Muslim. He is a woman-hating, Muslim-hating.
You're Iranian.
Iranian. He's not a big fan, which is interesting, right? Because he's like anti-Sharia, but like pro-Saudi.
Yeah.
Okay. I've been trying to decide, am I a Hillary girl or a Bernie girl?
Mm.
And the thing is, there are two things on my bucket list. One is dislikable woman in a position of power over the entire free world.
Okay. And the other?
To see the end of the world before I die.
Mm.
I feel like if my grandma in Iran, like, had the door kicked in by a bunch of guerrilla U.S. troops, and she was like, what's happening? And then I could tell her, Grandma, a woman is murdering everyone in the world, starting with Iran. She would be like, oh, well, at least it's a woman.
That's Zahra Norbakhsh, co-host of the podcast Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. Find a link and hear much more at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Now, our station is located on the southeast side of San Francisco, just down the hill from the second biggest city park, McLaren Park. In recent years, it's yo-yoed between ambitious improvement projects and periods of neglect. At one point, it even became a dumping ground for unwanted bathtubs, carpets, furniture, and worse, bodies. So in 2009, Rec and Parks partnered with both SF Utilities and the Arts Commission to clean things up and launch a project to make the park feel safer and more inviting. It's a nearly 3-mile trail that pairs walking with philosophy. KALW's Berenice Freedom put on her hiking boots to find out how an ancient Socratic practice changed McLaren's reputation.
I'm in McLaren Park, hiking south on a trail that follows the ridge of a grassy hill. To my left is a stunning view of Visitation Valley's row houses, painted orange and blue and pastel pink. SFO is just 10 miles south, so every few minutes the shadow of an airplane will bend across the grassy hills of San Bruno Mountain or drift across 10 lanes of cars surging along the 101. The trail I'm on is called the Philosopher's Way. It's designed to help visitors connect to nature and to think about the landscape, but also about the people who came here before them, or about those who will come in the future. There are 14 musing stations, each with a black stone plaque, that provides historical context and quotes from luminaries and make this an art project, not just a hiking trail. Here's a quote from one of them.
The butterfly counts not months, but moments, and has time enough.
The idea of a philosopher's walk isn't new. The project was modeled after similar walks in Japan, Europe, and Canada, but it is the first of its kind in the United States. Two artists created this project, Susan Swartzenberg and Peter Richards. They'd made several trips out here to figure out what kind of public art would have the most impact. Richards got the idea to do a walk when he came out early one morning and encountered a ghostly figure pacing in the forest.
Through the fog, I see this elderly Asian man who's kind of walking back and forth, and he's chanting through something pretty heavy, but it was a haunting image.
It got the artist talking about Socrates and Kitaro Nishida and other philosophers who would pair walking and thinking.
There is a kind of learning that's about walking.
That's co-creator Susan Schwarzenberg.
Often philosophers would take their students on this walk up into the hills and talk and reflect to give a little piece of that thinking to San Francisco. It seemed like a wonderful way to name this.
McLaren was always known as a scary place.
The artists observed that people who lived close by only visited their own small section of the park, partly because there was no easy way to explore all of it. The philosopher's way tried to fix that.
We realized that if we could just connect the different pathways, people could go all the way around the park. And I think there was a little contention from people about not wanting to wander out of their own zone where they felt safe. So I think that we were able to open that up so that now you do see people, you know, circumnavigating the whole park.
This wasn't the first time these artists have worked together. They were longtime collaborators at the Exploratorium. Separately, they've created a lot of public art. Richards created an acoustic sculpture called the Wave Organ in the marina, and Schwarzenberg designed the Rosie the Riveter Memorial in Richmond. After so much experience, the artists knew it can be a struggle to get community buy-in on public art. Richards explains that he and Schwarzenberg made sure people in the surrounding areas were a crucial part of creating this art trail.
Instead of feeling defensive and like we're intruders, which can often happen when you're doing public art, we felt like we joined a community, and Susan was particularly good at meeting with groups and getting them to talk about what was important, and that those conversations are reflected in some of the musing stations.
The musing stations are etched with information about their location, so you can ponder the view and a memory from a local resident. My favorite musing station overlooks the Cow Palace. It's incredibly moving, partly because it has no words. You come out of the woods, and there is George Conklin's stunning black and white photograph of Martin Luther King speaking to a packed audience in the Cow Palace in 1964. It's a vivid reminder of how much has happened here over the years.
I don't really think that Californians in general have a very deep sense of history because everything's so new here. And so every little bit that we can hold on to, I think, is very important.
That's Ruth Wallace, a community advocate and bird watcher who brings all of her out-of-town guests to the park. She walks her dogs here daily.
In the early morning, we see quite a lot of wildlife, coyotes for sure. And of course, raccoons, opossums, skunks. It's really a fun place to be every day. It gives you a little taste of nature to start the day.
Wallace has lived next door to McLaren Park for 14 years. She's been on the board of the Portola Neighborhood Association since 2009. That's also when Rec and Park joined forces with Public Utilities and the San Francisco Arts Commission to put a call out for ideas for a public art installation for McLaren Park. Once they had whittled down all the entries to three finalists, they asked the neighbors to pick a winner. Ruth Wallace had a vote.
I didn't actually vote on this one. I was hoping for something more sculptural, but I'm so happy with this, and I'm glad that my neighbors made this decision for me.
Local philosopher Nathaniel Paluga says he was also happy with that decision. He felt like the artist read his mind when they put in the Philosopher's Way Trail, since he was already using the place for physical and mental exercise.
The mind is connected to the body, and being in a healthy environment for the body leads to a healthy mind as well.
When Paluga isn't conducting tours of the Hate with SF City Guides, he'll lead discussion walks here on the way, posing questions from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Paluga says that the experience of walking while talking about philosophical concepts can help people be more aware of the world around them, but also the world within them.
In between the talking, we'll walk silently for a bit, and then we can take in a more ineffable state and sort of breathe the fresh air, take in the sunlight, and be here now.
On the hike today, I've passed families having parties and cookouts. I saw butterflies and accidentally spooked some ducks, and I stopped to enjoy my share of four-legged affection. I also got unique views of the city, both physically and throughout time. For me, exploring McLaren Park was time well spent today. What I found was a calmness of body and mind after a thoughtful, even soulful experience of San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Berenice Freedom.
Now that you've wandered with philosophers, journey over to kalw.org/subscribe and sign up for our podcast. You can listen to Cross Currents as you meander all over the Bay. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Lisa Bartfi, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Angela Johnston, Truk Nguyen, and Stephen Short. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Does that work?
This music is by Mitch Woods and his Rocket 88s. They'll be at Nick's Restaurant in Pacifica on Friday night, starting at 8 o'clock. Make sure to bring your dancing shoes. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
I want you. I want you. I want you too. I want